Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. So one thing about being me is that I'm still, even 20 years after playing Baldrick, stopped in the street and asked where my turnip is. So I thought I should lean into this in my podcast. Yes, today we're talking turnips in history. Have they always been so unloved? A food fit only for animals and peasants like Baldrick? Or is this a recent British bugbear? My two excellent guests today are going to help me out with this. The leading food historian of all things root veg, Rebecca Earle.
So songbirds and pears or things like that were perfect food for aristocrats, whereas things that grew underground were ideally suited to peasants. So you could map, you know, where your food originated with your position in the social hierarchy.
And a chef for all seasons, Oliver Rowe.
They are very good for our climate in the sense that they grow very easily. They love the conditions. And then once they're grown, they sit very, very happily in the ground. And so you can just leave them and they won't go off until the end of the food year. You can actually leave them in the ground all winter and then they'll be there for you in the spring when there's not so much around.
Before we get to that, Melissa, my producer, is here for a chat. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Tony. So I know why we're doing this podcast, because turnips, there's an obvious link. But what I loved when you told me about turnips, you got really excited. You said, Melissa, turnips made me rich and famous. And I just thought we've got to go with that because nobody else in the world can say that.
Probably very few people. Certainly Therese Coffey couldn't say that.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you told me something hilarious, which is you got calls when Therese Coffey said, we'll just remind our listeners what she said. She said, we should all be eating turnips.
Yeah, because there was a tomato shortage.
That's correct. There were tomato shortages and she's like, let's all eat turnips. Yeah. Nobody was convinced, I don't think. But what I loved about this story, Tony, you told me you got calls from journalists for quotes.
Oh, from the Today programme. Wanted me on. Newsnight wanted me on.
It's brilliant. You forever.
Well, I said no, turnip man. I haven't really got very much to say on the subject, but I would have if I had done this podcast at that time.
All in the aid of research.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, let's get on to it. Let's hear about turnips.
Turnips. We're talking about all things turnipy today with Professor Rebecca Earle from Warwick University, who is a food specialist and a turnip specialist, I think it's fair to say, isn't it? And Oliver Rowe, who is a marvellous chef and knows a great deal about turnips. We're talking about turnips, but in a way, they're a bit of a gag.
Everyone always likes turnips. Quite often, they think they don't like turnips. But I think deep down, once you tell people what they've had with turnips in, quite often they go, oh, yeah. Oh, pickled those little pickles. Yeah, no, I like those. Those are really nice.
I think the problem might be, certainly for my post-war generation, is that as I was growing up, everything was boiled in loads and loads of water for an extremely long time. And if there's one thing that wrecks a turnip, it's getting it sort of over soggy, isn't it?
Yeah, they can be cooked nicely, but yeah, boiled. Unless you're going to maybe mash them, put loads of cream and butter in there. That'd be quite nice. Maybe some pork fat or pork.
We're going to be talking, oh yes.
Bacon, lardons.
Bits of pork, yeah. Mm. Rebecca, do you like them?
I love turnips. I think they're wonderful. And I thought it was a very good omen for this whole podcast that the vegetable box that I get on the weekends, on the past weekend, had a turnip. It had the first turnip of the season.
Hooray.
And it both seemed like good luck. And I also thought, hurrah, this is a turnip. And I'm going to pickle it. I'm going to make it into one of those little North African sort of pickled vegetable platters that you can get on the side if you go to have
a little
bit of North African.
You get in a Turkish restaurant.
Yeah. And along with a little bit of beetroot. Maybe a chili, and they're lovely.
So when you opened the box and you saw it in there, did you think, well, that's a turn up for the books?
I made a note that no one was allowed to say that. Anyway, enough of this turnip gossip.
I'm so sorry.
Let's get serious. Where do they come from? When do we first know about the existence of turnips?
Well, that's a very good question. I think we should turn to the real turnip expert for the question of when they first arrived.
I haven't told you about this. We do have an expert with us, although not here in the studio. Hello, Sarin. This is Sarin Quinn. Where are you? Bonn?
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me here online. I'm in Bonn, Germany at the moment, so zooming in, so to speak. So when do we first have turnips? Well, that's a really good question and not one that we have a fixed answer for, unfortunately. There is a sort of rumour that they only appear in England in the 16th century, but this is probably actually a bit of confusion with the word turnip, which changes in the 16th century. So before that, in English, it's the word rapes, which comes from the Latin word rapa. And so if you follow that word back, you'll find that they're there from at least the 14th century. And probably they're there for much longer as well.
But that's in England, isn't it? If they had a Latin name, then presumably the Romans had them.
Oh, absolutely, yes. So Pliny talks about, that's Pliny the Elder, in the first century AD. He talks about them in his work, Natural History. And he talks about two types of turnips. So there's the rapa or rapum, and there's also the napus. And these are the two big turnip types throughout sort of early modern medieval history.
You say the two turnip types. Do we still have those two types today?
Well, we do, actually. So the one that's called napus is most probably actually what we think of as the Swede or rutabaga. And so for medieval, Roman or early modern people, these were actually both turnips, just different sort of kinds of them. Whereas the one that was called rapa is our turnip, so to speak.
Sarin, do we know where the word turnip comes from?
Yes, well, we think we do. We can never be entirely certain with etymology. But the idea is that the word turnip comes from turn, meaning the sort of roundness of a turnip, and neep. So neep is, again, this Swede. If you're a Scots listener, you'll be familiar with the word, because that's really what the Swede is still called in Scotland. And so you have a round neep, and that's your turnip.
Okay, so we got them in Roman times. In Europe. Mm. What about the rest of the world, or were they very much a European vegetable?
I think they were a European vegetable, although I'm not certain about that. That's my impression. But I mean, in some ways, we should really not think about Europe. We should think about Eurasia, because there was a huge amount of traffic back and forth, east and west, through this enormous landmass. So travelers were going back and forth. They were bringing all sorts of things back and forth in and out of Europe. And all kinds of foods were brought back and forth as well.
So you can imagine a Chinese baldric going back to his boss and saying, I have a turnip.
Exactly. It's quite possible. And I mean, in some ways also, there are historical examples of people talking about, of peasant farmers saying, well, you know, we grow things and when we run out, we go and we ask the master if we could have a turnip. So there are wonderful historical examples of people petitioning their employers for a turnip or two.
Are we buying into a bit of a cliche, talking continually about the peasants? Was it always a peasant food, or would Alfred the Great have liked to have a turnip on his plate?
Well, if you look at recipes, which are one possible way we can research what people were eating in the past, you find turnips appearing at all kinds of different levels of the social spectrum. There was a really nice recipe I saw from the end of the 1700s for a bed of mashed potatoes with a lot of butter and cream. And then you made four little indentations in the bed of mashed potatoes. And into one of them, you put some cooked spinach. And into another, you put mashed turnip. So you had the combination of mashed potato and mashed turnip. You put some carrots in the third one, and then you put some little boiled onions in a sauce in the fourth, and you drizzled that with more butter, and you served that up. So that was a rather fancy dish.
Oh, exactly.
So that's a rather nice fancy dish to serve as a side dish on your fine dinner table. But they were also a staple of peasant food. And you can find recipes that have names like a cheap soup, where you put it like a potato, a turnip, one herring, pints of water, a carrot, and boil it up. And then you could serve this to the poor of the parish. So it played across all sorts of different social spectrums.
Going back to what Rebecca raised about turnips as a side dish, how do you serve them?
They're a funny old one because you can eat them in almost any way. So you can, we talked about boiled turnips earlier. You can roast them, you can mash them, you can fry them. So I've opened this out to my broader culinary friends, and they've been chipping in as well with some nice ideas. But turnip rosties as well, which sounds great.
How do you do that?
So you grate it. With some potato though, and then maybe chop some kale into it, and then you make a little, just from raw, you'll just cook that like that, salted and like a little patty, you know, a rosti, you know, little potato cake like that. But turnip soup is actually very delicious as well if you make it right, and you get really lovely background flavours with sweet onion and so on, and then you just cook it just enough so you've still got the lovely flavours of the turnip. It's actually really, really delicious. One of my favourite turnip/non-turnip dishes is called grilled turnip cake. And that's, we're talking about China, and that's a Chinese recipe.
That, yeah.
And they make it with mooli or daikon, but you can also make it with turnips. And again, one of the reasons why it's so delicious. And it's like a little square or rectangle of white paste. It just doesn't look particularly appealing. But then they fry it, and then you have it with chili oil, and it's utterly delicious.
Oliver, you're holding in your hand a jar which looks suspiciously like your own product. Tell me what it is.
So I make kimchi, and I brought it on not just to plug that I make kimchi, but also because the key ingredient in kimchi is what we call Chinese leaf or Chinese cabbage, which isn't actually a cabbage. It's a cultivated variety of the turnip leaf.
So this is Ollie's turnip kimchi.
Yeah, well, in many ways, yes, it is. And the other main ingredient is daikon, which is a radish, which is a very, very close relative of the turnip.
For those people who don't know, what is kimchi?
Kimchi, it's a Korean pickle, basically. And again, like a pickle, it's something that you can have with all sorts of ingredients.
It's lovely. It's really crunchy, as you can probably hear on the microphone. Quite spicy,
quite spicy,
isn't it? Yeah, I can feel it going down my pipe.
Oh, that's got a lovely smell.
I love the smell. Mm. Cabbages basically have certain bacteria and yeast that grow on them, which naturally make it so they lacto-ferment very
quickly. Is that why sauerkraut works in the way that it
exactly.
does? You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, and my very special guests talking turnips this week are veg historian Professor Rebecca Earle and the turnip-loving chef Oliver Rowe. And also joining us online is historian and turnip expert Serin Quinn.
Not many people get called turnip experts.
Very few, Melissa. Very few. So, you've got your turnip in the medieval field. Who are its friends? Who are its neighbours? What's in there with it?
Well, its best friend is what was called the navu, and this is this other kind of turnip that I had mentioned, the napus. Or swede. Alongside it, you'd have the parsnip and the carrot. You'd also have radishes eventually, but actually not quite as many sort of root vegetables as we would perhaps expect. But actually thinking of that kimchi, there's actually a medieval recipe, which is called compost, which uses a lot of these root vegetables to make a sort of relish, a sort of vinegary relish.
It's not a very pretty name, is it?
Well, it comes from the original meaning of the word compost, which is to mix together lots of various things. So that's why we sort of call the fertilized stuff compost, yeah.
So on a posh menu, you might get a compote.
Exactly. Well, it's a similar sort of concept.
Carrots and parsnips, do we know much about their antecedents?
Yes. So carrots and parsnips are all part of the same family, which also includes parsley, cumin, coriander, dill, fennel. They are all the same family. They're not the brassicas, which are the cabbage family. And so they're not generally seen as so good for lactoferment and so on and so forth. But they are very, very good for our climate in the same way as turnips are and beetroot, which are another family altogether. But they are very good for our climate in the sense that they grow very easily. They love the conditions. And then once they're grown, they sit very, very happily in the ground. And so you can just leave them and they won't go off until towards the end of the year. So I say the end of the year, the end of the food year. And I'm not going to start plugging my book, but that's about the food year. And that being starting in October, really, and ending in September. But in the middle of that is April, which is the month that you can actually leave them in the ground all winter, and then they'll be there for you in the spring when there's not so much around.
And have those other vegetables been around as long as turnips have, do we think?
Yeah, they've all played an important role in feeding ordinary people for 1,000 years, if not much, much longer. Well, 2,000, I mean, as we saw, we have names in Latin for various of these root vegetables. I mean, the thing also to think about is that our classifications, whether we think of them as being in the same family as cabbages or things like that, are based on modern ideas about science, and that in the past, people had different ways of classifying foods and thinking about what was similar to what. So all of these things that grew under the ground and produced a kind of knobbly root were thought about as friends and bedfellows. They were roots. They were one sort of root or another. And so when new roots, like the potato, arrived from Latin America, brought over by the invading Europeans, brought back to Europe, people thought about those as roots as well. And so you get a whole category of rooty things, which are all similar in their underground subterranean tendencies.
Well, I think most of us think the same way now, don't we?
Exactly.
The pitch of my question was very much assuming that they were all bedfellows.
Exactly. Science isn't the only way to think about our food. I don't mean to say that it's incorrect or wrong, but it's not the only way that people relate to what they eat.
Serin, we're talking about vegetables which we know nowadays. Were there any other root vegetables at that time which have just kind of disappeared or gone out of fashion?
Well, absolutely. So we think of the turnip as being sort of a bit left out these days, but it's actually one of the lucky ones that made it all the way to this century. Two big, well, not actually big, but popular root vegetables from the medieval period were called skirrets and oringos. So skirrets and oringos are another sweet roots, and they're really valued for being sweet. Skirrets are a sort of strange root vegetable because they don't produce one singular root. They produce a lot of little tiny roots. And oringos also, you can sort of think of them as a very small parsnip. So they take a lot of work to actually peel and clean and cook. And so that might be one of the reasons why they sort of fell out of fashion. But as Rebecca says, you get the introduction of potato roots, both sweet potatoes and ordinary potatoes in the 16th century. And these sort of start to push out perhaps the skirrets and oringos.
So are skirrets and oringos still around? Could we find them and cook them if we wanted to, or are they just disappeared completely off the map?
Well, yes, you can still buy seed to grow them yourself. I actually have eaten skirrets myself because I have a friend who grows novelty vegetables. I've probably had more skirret than I have turnips. And for oringos, you might know them as sea holly. So people now grow it for its flower, which is sort of like a blue thistle. But people don't really eat them so much unless you're into novelty food.
We've been talking so far about the turnip really in its windswept field. It really is quite a sort of Monty Python view of the world, isn't it? The turnip is tucked under someone's armpit and they've just got kind of rags on. But Rebecca, I remember reading somewhere someone saying that the turnip was as important to the Industrial Revolution as the steam engine. Is that justifiable, or is it a bit of a hyperbole?
Well, it grabs your attention. So the Industrial Revolution depended on having industrial proletarianized workers, and that required more productive agriculture, and the turnip was absolutely crucial to that. They were really important. Turnips in the 1700s were a matter of government interest at a high level, and it was connected to agriculture. So that during this period, from really the 1600s and the 1700s, there was a problem with food in Western Europe. The population was growing, and how was this growing population going to be fed? There was a big effort to try to get more food out of the limited amount of land that was available in Europe. I mean, this also went side by side with colonialism. I mean, one way you could solve a food problem is by colonizing somewhere else and importing a lot of food from there, which was ultimately the British approach, you know, decades and centuries later. But one of the things people were trying to do was to get more land into cultivation, changing the way in which fields were used. So in the medieval period, there was what was often called a four-field system used, where you would have fields that you would cultivate for a certain amount of time, and then every fourth year, let's say, you would leave it to lie fallow. So it would just rest, and it would have a chance to recover its strength before you then sowed it again. But that means that a quarter of your agricultural land is out of production at any moment, right?
Yes.
So if you could stop doing that, you would substantially increase the amount of land under cultivation. To do that required some way of allowing, or not of forcing almost, that land to become more fertile more quickly than it naturally would. And one of the things that people were really interested in Western Europe in the 1700s was crops that you could plant on this land that would produce some kind of crop and that would actually at the same time also enrich the soil.
So was this really the time when turnips first started to be used in a large-scale way as a food for animals?
So turnips were one of these crops that could be both fed to animals, it could be fed to people, it was good for the soil, it would increase the amount of land under cultivation. So not just the government, but all kinds of patriotic organizations up and down the British Isles and in fact other parts of Europe were testing turnips, experimenting with turnips. These gentlemen who often, you know, wouldn't have gone anywhere near a field started getting very interested in turnips and their potential as a patriotic crop that was going to make Britain strong and powerful and with a bigger population, which could then beat France. So they were really, you know, important to government policy.
That's as wonderful.
As long as you beat the French, everything's fine.
Yeah, I feel incredibly grateful to the turnip for saving me from the French.
That was pretty true.
Yeah.
So turnips really were a topic of great interest to patriotic figures who wanted to do everything they could to increase the strength of the British population and thereby the strength of the British state.
Tell us about Turnip Townsend.
He was one of these agricultural promoters who was noted for his patronizing and promoting of the turnip as this really important crop that people should be growing for precisely the reasons that we've been discussing. His name indicated that people, you know, this was not, I think, perhaps a title that he would have chosen himself or that was perhaps endowed him with the air of august majesty that he might have wished to have. But it was an indication that people were really pushing turnips as a thing that people ought to be growing, not just for their own well-being, but in order to strengthen the British state.
Okay, so we're talking about turnips as the Beyoncé of the field system, except she has a nemesis coming out of the Americas, the potato. Sarin, tell us about the impact that the potato had.
So potatoes, and in fact sweet potatoes, arrive in England at about 1580. And in fact, the word potato comes from the word for sweet potato in the Taino language in the Caribbean. So it's actually really the sweet potato is the sort of driving potato of the 16th century.
So what was that original word?
It was batata. So the word potato just comes from a BP flip from batata to patata. And that's the sweet potato. That's your original potato name. And so ordinary potatoes, what we sort of think of as potatoes, were called potatoes of Virginia. And this is also a bit of a confusion because they're not actually from Virginia, they're from Peru. And your sweet potatoes were called potatoes of Spain, or sometimes actually Peruvian skirrets. So I mentioned the skirrets earlier, and they make a lot of comparisons between skirrets, which are very sweet, and your sweet potato.
And so you gave a date as to when they came over. How did that happen?
So originally, the sweet potatoes were first discovered, so to speak, so perceived by Europeans as early as Columbus's first voyage in 1492. And the Spanish start to bring over sweet potatoes and eventually ordinary potatoes once they find them in Peru to Spain. But sweet potatoes can't be really cultivated in the English environment as a crop food. So you can grow them in your garden if you put a fair amount of work into them, but you can't sell them as a crop at all. And so sweet potatoes had to be imported from Spain. And this meant that they were very expensive food. They're sort of associated with quite high dining and even the queen and king ate potatoes.
So when we're talking about the introduction of potatoes into England and the royalty and the queen getting so exercised about potatoes, we're actually talking about sweet potatoes, at least to start with.
Well, sweet potatoes were sort of perceived to be the slightly better potato. So they did like both of them, absolutely. But sweet ones are obviously, by the name, much sweeter, and sweetness is a very highly important factor for medieval and early modern diets. So the sweet potato is sort of perceived as being slightly superior, but it's more helpful to sort of see them as being perceived of even in the same sort of group of foods. So potatoes can be sort of sweet or ordinary, or even Jerusalem artichokes, which were for a brief time called potatoes of Canada.
Now, there's an interesting fact. That's totally wrong-footed me. I had no idea. Do they really come from Canada?
Well, yes, they come from North America. They don't actually come from Jerusalem at all. So Jerusalem artichoke is also a completely nonsense name for the plant, but there you have it.
Do you know where that name comes from?
So, I mean, all of these names are really interesting. They tell you something about what people thought about these new foods when they arrived. So Jerusalem artichoke as a name is thought to have been a corruption of the word, not Jerusalem, but the Italian word for sunflower, because they're actually from the sunflower family. So the Italian word is girasole, because they turn towards the sun. As anybody who's ever seen a field of sunflowers will know, they all line up like little soldiers looking in the direction of wherever the sun is. And so Jerusalem artichokes are a type of girasole. Girasole eventually becomes Jerusalem. And the artichoke actually is because they're considered to have a flavor that's not dissimilar to that of the globe artichoke. So it's a kind of a useful name in a sense that actually tells you something about the botanical family. They're connected to sunflowers and a little bit about their flavor, even if it also leads you off completely in the wrong direction in terms of where they might originate. But their name in French is also interesting. Jerusalem artichokes in French are called topinambour, which comes from, again, a corruption of the name of an indigenous group in Brazil, the Tupinamba. So they're somehow this foreign, exotic food from the Americas, perhaps. So some people think that topinambour is just a way of saying outlandish from somewhere else. Or it could be that it's pegging them to the Americas. But names are really interesting historically.
Aren't they just?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So we've been talking about the potato, this nouveau turnip, as it were, which came as a fancy dish to the royal family. But it does seem like it spread exponentially.
Potatoes were super successful as a global food. They've gone all around the world. And one of the things that's really interesting about the potato as it's traveled around the world is the way in which wherever it lands up, it really pretty quickly became something totally ordinary and local, unlike the Jerusalem artichoke, which had all of these exotic sobriquets attached to it, suggesting it was from somewhere else. The names the potatoes picked up, sometimes they marked them out as foreign, sometimes, but very often they embedded them right there in the locale. And so our potato names, we think of them as embedded in Britain. You know, we have King Edwards, we have Jersey Royals, we have names that tell us that they're from right exactly actually here.
Yeah.
Whereas they're not. They're from like way the hell on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, over on the spine of the Andes Mountains. So potatoes not only emigrate all around the world, but they naturalize. And people think of them as just like ordinary stuff that's from right here. They're not like, you know, your avocados, which are from somewhere else. They're a really successful immigrant food.
If you talk about the history of potatoes, I'd imagine one of the two or three facts that people would know about them is the Irish potato famine.
Mm.
So what preceded it? How come there are all these potatoes in Ireland?
Well, potatoes probably reached Ireland via Spain. So it makes sense if potatoes, as they originated in South America, and it was the Spanish invasion of South America in the 1500s that brought the potato to the consciousness of Europeans, and that therefore it makes sense that it was Spaniards who brought them back to Europe. So you'd imagine they'd probably arrive in Spain first, right? Which just seems to be what they did. The story that they were brought back by Sir Walter Raleigh or Francis Drake or something like that just doesn't hold water.
Oh, no!
I'm sorry to say.
Do you know when that story first appeared?
Well, it certainly was kicking around in the 1700s because it really annoyed the Spanish. Because by then, the potato was a popular crop with the government. Potatoes were seen just the same way that governments were really interested in trying to increase agricultural productivity. They were also really interested in finding cheap, healthy foods for working people. And all across Europe, potatoes were being identified as like a really good food you should be getting the population to eat. So potatoes had a sort of moment of popularity. There's a wonderful quote from some French journalist writing like in the 1780s. And he says, that's all people ever talk about in salons these days, you know, potatoes. It's getting boring. Why would they talk about something else? So potatoes.
My wife's like that in the restaurant. Can we have chips?
The potatoes were popular. Delicious. And so these stories were circulating about how Drake or Raleigh had brought
yes.
back this great, wonderful food. And the Spanish were saying, over here, we brought it back. We were the ones who did it. Us, not those, you know, not those English people. And other people were then writing, sometimes even some Spanish writers were saying, well, we should all be really grateful to Drake for bringing us the potato. And the Spanish were saying, just a minute.
I really hate historians sometimes. The few things that all of us know about history are almost always taken away from us. No, that wasn't true.
Well,
it was
something
just a folk tale. Yeah, pay me back, yeah.
Okay, potatoes were perhaps surprisingly to us considered to be possibly an aphrodisiac.
Oh, the room fell silent for a moment. Carry on.
So
they were potato.
How would you administer it?
Well, you take it by mouth.
Okay.
You'd be relieved to know. So potatoes were considered, along with a number of other root vegetables, to be windy, as the expression went. They provoked flatulence. This was something Europeans commented on quite a bit. And they were these windy roots. And there was a general sense in this period that things that were windy, that inflated you, that puffed you up, that filled your body up with air, might have a similarly filling and enhancing and lifting effect on the relevant parts of your body for sexual encounters. So potatoes were often put into this category as windy and therefore lascivious roots.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you My Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Census, Coronation, Nights, What the Past Smelt Like, loads and loads. You're going to find something you like, aren't you? Let's return for one moment to the Irish potato
yes,
famine.
Yeah, which is that is no joking matter whatsoever. I mean, it resulted out of a population of 8 million people or so. This was in the 1840s. I mean, something like a million people died of either starvation or of diseases that preyed on weakened bodies. And another million or so emigrated, both going westward to the United States, particularly eastward into Great Britain. So it had a devastating effect on not just the population at the time, but on subsequent generations who were living with this trauma of massive death. And there are terrible stories and firsthand accounts of people, whole families lying, waiting to die in their small cabins with not even, you know, people come to visit them, hoping to perhaps be able to revive them with some sweet tea. And they say, we've not got anything to boil the water with. We've not got any water. We're living off the water that's dripping off our roof into this tiny cup. So it was a time of tremendous, terrible suffering.
Oliver.
Oh, but also preventable, because it was due to the way that the land had been managed by the British and the way that we'd been slowly handing power from into the hands of the people that owned the land. And so it became a monocrop and nobody had any access to anything other than the potato, and they couldn't afford anything else. And we saw it happening and we did nothing about it.
That's absolutely right. And the other thing to say, though, about potatoes is that the reason that this was possible, that families could be, as they were, subsisting off potatoes, is that, to go back to this 18th century sense that the potato was a really great crop, it is a really great crop. If you were going to try to keep your body and soul together off a tiny, tiny patch of land and you could plant on it whatever you wanted, you would be hard-pressed to find anything better than potatoes to grow, because you can get more calories out of an area of land growing potatoes than with almost any other foodstuff. So it's possible to survive with a tiny plot of land if you raise potatoes on them. So in some ways, it was the agricultural and nutritional potency of the potato that was made it possible for this totally unjust system of land tenure to sustain itself. And people said that at the time. They said the potato is at the root of all of this. This is the cause of misery in Ireland. If the potato wasn't around, that wouldn't have been possible for people to stay alive in such immiserated circumstances. And they blame the potato.
While the potato was becoming so dominant, it was kind of pushing the turnip off the menu, wasn't it? Until, by the time I was a kid, the turnip was just a gag.
Until you brought it back.
Yeah.
Well, how did you eat it when you were growing up?
When we didn't eat it in my house. My mum and dad were both working class but very aspiring. They were what used to be called, you never hear the phrase lower middle class now, do you? But that's what my mum and dad were in their semi-detached in South Woodford. But no, my mum wouldn't have wanted turnip on the menu, because she would have seen it as something not worthy of being on the menu.
I very similar for me. I mean, I remember it being it. Every time you go to a greengrocer, there'd be turnips and swedes all over the place, but nobody ever seemed to eat them. So I was never sure who was buying them or why they were there, but, you know, they were.
Well, it had got to such a state of ignorance that when we first started doing Blackadder, and I, for the first time, I had a reference to turnips, oh, I do like that lovely turnip kind of thing, which was supposed to be a laugh line, I went to Ben Elton and said, I don't understand. I can't see what is funny about a turnip, certainly not in a kind of double entendre sort of way, which you seem to be implying. And he said, well, yes, it's hysterically funny, he said, because think what turnips look like. They're like sort of, you know, round at the bottom, aren't they? And they go up long, 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 like, you know, like a thingy. And I said, no, Ben, that's parsnips. And he said, whatever, whatever, it'll be funny. And I said, no, you're telling me you want to make a rude joke about something that doesn't look like the thing you make rude jokes about. And he said, I know, it'll be really hysterical. I said, look, you're much younger than me, Ben. I've been in the business a long time. I'm telling you, it won't work. But I reluctantly said the gag on the night of the recording, and the audience laughed and laughed and laughed, yeah. Which shows how much I know about show business. But it's quite extraordinary, wasn't it? Because the audience must have had it somehow subconsciously, that same confusion between the parsnip and the turnip that I had. And as we've said earlier on, they're not even in the same family.
But Miriam Margolyes is presented at some point with something, when she's dressed up as a nun, with something that's supposed to be a turnip, but which actually has no resemblance to a turnip. It looks like it's a horseradish.
It does, doesn't it?
Which is obviously named after something which is very sexual. So that's kind of like, you know, but if it was, then she wouldn't have been able to bite into it.
Sorry, what's sexual? A horse or a radish?
It looks like a horse's.
Oh, is that, I suppose.
Have you ever seen a raw horseradish root?
A raw
horseradish root?
I don't think I have.
They look like that. They're like that. And so what she bites into looks a lot like a peeled horseradish.
When Oliver said they look like that, he made a gesture which I won't describe to you. I just leave it to your imaginations. what about nowadays, Oliver? Stop gesturing. Gesturing nonstop for the last 30 seconds.
Very funny.
How would you incorporate the turnip into your menus?
Actually, I've got a couple of go-to turnip recipes. One of them is glazed turnips. I don't know if you know Vichy carrots, which is where you get carrots and then you glaze them with butter and a little sugar and salt and you cook them down till they've got a little caramelly sauce, which kind of coats them. Turnips are perhaps even better when you cook them like that. So you put them in a pan with a cartouche, a piece of baking parchment over them, like more butter than you think is really at all healthy, a good pinch of salt and a little bit of sugar. It means they slowly cook, keep it on a low heat. The water eventually evaporates, the butter caramelizes, the turnips themselves caramelize a little bit, and the whole thing just goes sweet and sticky and delicious. And it goes really, really well with duck. And duck and turnips, they just really, so duck can take anything sweet. So you can have it with plums, classic Chinese thing, oranges, marmalade. Duck and marmalade, delicious. Any jam, pretty much. And so glazed turnips, which have this wonderful sweetness, they balance really well. And my other one, which is much simpler, is just they're delicious raw. The baby ones in particular, or if you get a light, slightly bigger one, you have to peel it enough so that you don't get that tough outside skin, but then shaved. So if you have like a mandolin or one of the slicey parts of a grater, or just if you're good with a knife, if you shave it, you can turn that into a salad on its own, like a kind of reddish salad, or you can just run that through another salad. So a green salad just gives a bit of crunch. And so turnips, as they're part of the mustard family, they come from that side of the brassicas, which is the cabbage family. They have a little bit of that heat. Horseradish is also from the same part of the brassica family. So they have that a little bit of that hint of almost bitterness, heat, and then lots of sweetness. And it just, they just really bring that to the salad.
How do you feel about duck and turnip, Serin?
Well, funnily enough, duck and turnip is one of the earliest turnip recipes we have from medieval England. So duck and turnip soup is quite a popular one back in the day. Personally, I'm a vegetarian, so it wouldn't work for me. But clearly it's something that continues to work throughout the centuries.
Do we know anything about that recipe?
It's just a sort of boiling turnips and duck together, adding your sort of typical medieval spices, which is sort of ginger, cinnamon. Quite a simple recipe, really. A lot of the sort of soups from the Middle Ages are quite straightforward like that.
There is another recipe, isn't there, from the Second World War, a pie recipe that's quite legendary and has a turnip constituent.
Oh, the Wooten pie.
Yeah.
Yes, I think if I'm remembering correctly, this was basically a root vegetable pie that was being promoted by the Ministry of Food during the Second World War. I think that's right. And Lord Wooten was one of the important figures in British food policy during the Second World War, so he had a pie named after him. But there were all sorts of attempts to be shifting the population onto root vegetables and away from, both from meat as much as possible, but also away from grains, because grains were in much shorter supply. There was a big push to get the potato crop up during the Second World War. In fact, the propaganda, or encouragement of potato cultivation was so successful that at certain points during the Second World War, there was actually more potatoes in Britain than they were succeeding in shifting onto people. But there were lots of recipes that were being produced encouraging housewives to be adding potatoes and other root vegetables to every single meal of the day from breakfast through tea time and dinner. And so this, I think, was a root vegetable pie which I think there's no reason to think it wasn't delicious. And actually, there's a long history of making root vegetable pies from the 1700s, when we have lots and lots of cookery books and lots of manuscript recipes. There are lots of things where you have a crust and you layer in root vegetables and you pour on some cream and you might toss in some sugar, because people often like to sweeten these root vegetables, picking up on the natural sweetness that's just been discussed.
Are there any other old recipes, different ways of using turnip that we haven't covered so far, Serin?
Well, my favourite turnip recipe is from 1591, and it's to make a pudding in a turnip. And so this is something I think we really should bring back. So you peel and hollow out your turnips, and you fill them with a stuffing made of bread, apples, currants, hard-boiled eggs, sugar, cinnamon, ginger. And then you put that into your hollowed-out turnip. Boil it in water, butter, claret wine, some more spices, some more dates and currants, and you serve that up when it's tender. And I think that sounds quite exciting as a bit of a pudding.
It's like Christmas pudding with turnip and hard-boiled eggs, isn't
it? Yeah, the hard-boiled egg in there does sounds slightly odd, I have to say, in a sweet pudding. I can imagine it if it was savoury, but in a pudding, that sounds odd. But I can imagine it working. I can actually imagine that being very delicious, and especially the remaining the jus or the liquor yeah. that they're cooked in. Wow, that probably tastes amazing.
It sounds like a dream for Baldrick. I mean, something to do with an enormous turnip.
It is, yes. I could, that enormous turnip could be absolutely filled with currants
with
and
more
brandy.
Turnip.
Yes. Wow. Imagine the saucepan you'd need to do it in. It'd be a good one.
A lot of the time that we've been talking about turnips, there's been a twinkle in our eye, hasn't there? Because turnips are a gag. They're a gag, and they're a gag about poor people, about kind of stupid people like Baldrick. Why are they so stigmatised? And has that always been the case?
Well, I want to put in a good word for Baldrick to begin with, who I don't think was so stupid. I think at some point in the final episode, he's being mocked by Blackadder when he's joined the Socialist Party or something like that, and he's being told he's stupid. And he says, I don't think it's stupid to not want to sleep in a puddle. I mean, I shouldn't quote back to you your own lines. But I thought, yep, that's about sums it up. But maybe the turnip is equally misunderstood as being this jokey food. But I think the reason we think of turnips as being lowly food is because actually for hundreds and hundreds of years in Europe, there was an idea about what sorts of foods were appropriate for people at the bottom end of the social spectrum and what sorts of foods were appropriate for people at the top end of the social spectrum. And the idea was, as this has been put forward by a wonderful food historian called Alan Grieco, and he argued that the higher up you were on the social spectrum, the higher off the ground your food ought to originate from. So songbirds and pears or things like that were perfect food for aristocrats, whereas things that grew underground were ideally suited to peasants. So you could map the height of your food, you know, where your food originated, with your position in the social hierarchy. And there was a medical theory that went behind this, that these light, airy foods that were soaring through the breezes or perched on the tops of tree trunks were light and easy to digest. They maybe weren't the most nourishing foods in the world, but they were very easy to digest. They were delicate foods. And rich people who sat around and engaged maybe in some intellectual labor, but, you know, basically they didn't do an enormous amount, their systems were very delicate and couldn't cope with foods that were difficult to digest. Whereas hardy working people who labored in the field all day had very hot systems. Their stomachs, which were basically a sort of form of cooking pot, would cook their food very effectively. And these foods that grew under the ground were full of nourishing potential, but were tough on the digestion. So they were perfect food for these hardy working people who could also digest things like beans and brown bread and stuff like that would also overwhelm the system of an aristocrat. So there's a long idea that lowly earthy people should eat subterranean vegetables. And I think that association, in other words, is not just a sort of invention. I think it has some historical lineage.
On that thought, I will ask you all one final question, which I always ask on this podcast. It's, do you have a cunning plan for turnips? And really what I'm asking for is how you see they might sit in the future, or indeed with Oliver, what you might do with them in the future.
I think fermenting and pickling them is definitely a good way forward. People are really, really getting into fermentation these days. It's very good for you. It helps preserve foods in their season and for later on in the year. So I definitely see that as a way forward. But also I think just going back to some things like, you know, the turnip soup, turnip mash, you're seeing it as an ingredient. I also wanted to ask a quick question to you, Tony. Do you, I mean, being like the embodiment of turnip and turnip history, do you actually like turnips?
I like turnips when they're done really well. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of foods like, you know, a pizza or something, which you'll eat with a smile on your face, even if it's a bit rubbish.
Yeah.
But to me, a turnip has to be nurtured. It has to have love. And that love will inevitably include the word butter. And salt.
Yes.
And if it's baked, I guess it should be a bit crispy like a baked potato.
Yeah.
But yeah, you gotta love them, gotta give them some care.
That's lucky, considering, you know, you've had a lifelong association with them.
Saryn, cunning plan for turnip.
I was reading up about a Swiss festival, which is all about turnips, and it happens in November. And you carve turnips and you fill them with candles and you make these beautiful parade floats, which are all made of glowing turnips. And I'd really love to see that one day. So that's my cunning plan, is to one day finally go to. It's called the Rebelichtli in Switzerland.
One last thought from you.
I think they're a really good crop in our era of climate change because, as Oliver was saying, they grow really well in British soil. So I think it's a lovely thing to be eating if we're trying to be eating more locally sourced foods, if we're trying to connect to what the environment actually wants to be bringing forth. Turnips are one of the things it would like to bring forth, and so I think we should relish them. And we've been given a whole array of mouthwatering sounding recipes from Oliver, and if you know, a few from historic ones from Saryn that might merit trying out as well. Mm. So that would be my push and my plug for the turnip, is to think of them as a locally grown, very adaptable, climate-friendly food source.
Thank you very much, all of you. Absolutely fascinating. I've done really well from turnips over the last 40 years. I hope we have done well by the turnip. Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast is produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.